This is J. Lewis Mills, and you are about to be put on the level with J. Lewis Mills. Whether it's truth, controversy, good news, or bad. If it offends you, I'm sorry. If you agree, that's great. We talk about it all here because everything needs to be put on the level. Come in and join the conversation. I promise you'll be glad you did. I know I said it last week, but I have to say it again. I just will never get sick of listening to my intro. That hypes me up every single time. Hello, you guys got me. It's J. Lewis Mills. I am the host of On the Level with J. Lewis Mills. Good evening, good night, good morning, depending on where in the world you are listening to me. I hope you all had a great week. I had an interesting one. I'm not going to get into it too much because this is going to be a show of inspiration and positivity. So, having said that, I just want to dive right into it and just start with a little bit of a story. So, you all, my listeners and people that have gone to either my social media or looked me up on IMDb, you know that I was like honored and grateful and humbled to be asked to be in the latest Quentin Tarantino movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. When I talk to people about that, I tell them that basically I got paid to go to a master class. Because I had the opportunity to work with and just sit back and watch some of the greats in our industry do their thing. Whether I was sitting watching actors, whether I was sitting watching Mr. Tarantino do his thing, or whether I was sitting watching how professional the crew was, the production crew. And I met my guest tonight on the set of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. One thing that I will say, you know, there are times where people make connections on a film set or on a TV set, and you exchange information, you exchange social media information, and that's exactly what this young lady did. She gave me her Instagram. And when I went to follow her, I noticed something that it in a sense, and I know she's not going to take this offensively, and I'm pretty sure my listeners won't either, but I noticed something that, you know, kind of shocked me. It said autism and cerebral palsy. And I'm sitting, I'm thinking, I'm like, wait a minute. I didn't know who she was, but I didn't know that. I didn't notice any of that. So when we, and I also know, well, she'll get into telling you what she's done, but I also noticed some of her achievements, and that blew me away. So when I saw her at work the next day, I mentioned to her that, you know, I'm doing my show. This is when my show was on hiatus. I mentioned to her that I was doing my show, and for, I'd say, a little more than the last year, I have been in contact with her, promising her, I promise you, my show is coming back, I'm going to have you on, I promise you. We went to, I forgot what the event was, but it was something involving Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And I saw her and I said, I promise you, I'm going to have my show coming back and I promise to have you on. And tonight is her night. So I would like to introduce to you and I would like to have come on the air, Miss Joelle Posey Greger. How are you doing, ma'am?
I am doing well. That was such a sweet intro, Jay. You are so kind.
Well, thank you for giving me a reason to be so kind. So to start out, you know, mm-hmm. I always like to have my guests I say it's making a baseline so that people understand basically why you're here and why we're having the conversation. So if you wouldn't mind just explaining, because I think my guests can explain to my listeners better than I can who they are and the blessings that they've had in their journey. So just take a few moments and explain yourself to my listeners and let them know who you are.
Alrighty. My name is Joelle Posey Gregor, as Jay Lewis said. I think it's easiest, it seems kind of crazy, but let's go back to when I was born.
Yes.
I actually almost died at birth because of a beta strep infection. And as I was fighting for my life, I had a lack of oxygen to my brain. And that's actually what caused the cerebral palsy. Then, a short while after that, I'd say, I think it was around 18 months to 2 years, and my older brother is autistic as well. He was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder when he was only a few years old. And his therapist actually saw similar symptoms being exhibited in me. And so I had extremely early intervention and began going to occupational therapy. And that was on top of my physical therapy I was already doing for the cerebral palsy. And so it took a lot of time, a lot of therapy appointments. I pretty much felt like I was living in the hospital between me and my brother and all of our appointments. And our occupational therapist actually said, one of the best things you can do for these young children who have autism is allow them to not feel ostracized by going to a hospital time and time again. Why not enroll them in an acting class? Because that's very similar to the social cues. We work on scripts here in our therapy sessions, and it's about understanding social cues and how other people react, how you should react, how to understand and interpret that in the world. And so we started doing acting classes. And so that's actually how I was introduced into the world of entertainment and film and television. And I was terrified and I loved every second of it, but I was crying behind the curtain and was so terrified. And that fear, it really, was a difficult thing to overcome, but my teachers, my parents, my siblings, they all really recognized my love and passion for it. And so they encouraged me to be able to overcome that fear. And I think I did. I have been acting for over 20 years now, and it's one of my favorite things in the world. Probably improv is actually one of the top highlights in my life, getting to do improvisation, which is also terrifying, not knowing what is going to happen, scenarios and things, but it's fantastic. So that's kind of a little bit about me, and kind of where I started out and the difficulties that I have had to maneuver. There have definitely been harder days or frustrating days where I can't, play basketball as easily as other people, and I would still try. And, I'm definitely one of the lucky ones that was able to really enjoy all of my passions and continue to thrive in a multitude of arenas that I want to now give back to. So I've been doing a lot of volunteering, and I know we've discussed before my pageant career.
Ma'am.
There's lots to talk about there. So I don't know if you want me to continue on or if you want to
Well,
take it from here.
I do want to ask you a question, and I do want you to talk about that. But you said something interesting. You said that your therapists or your doctors said that putting you in an acting class would be good for you. This might be an unfair question, Joelle, but I'm Jay Lewis and this is my show, so I kind of do that sometimes. Do you think that if you would not have had the problems at birth, and let me just say as a side note, I know what you were going through being in the hospital so much because I lived in the hospital when I was a kid. I there were times when, and it was crazy because it always seemed like I was in the hospital when the children's hospital telethon was going on, and they always had me on television doing that. But do you think that if you would not have had the obstacles that you had when you were younger, do you think you still would have gotten into acting? Or do you, or is this in a sense a silver lining to a dark cloud, so to speak?
I definitely think the side of performing and the entertainment world would have come calling at some point in my life. I think it's so ingratiated into my soul. I am one to believe, and I say this all the time, that, you know, everything happens for a reason, and ultimately I have such a passion for acting. Even if I'm 60 or 70 years old, I'm still going to have to find a way to act because it's something so a part of who I am. So it might not have happened quite as young, but I'm pretty sure it would find me eventually. I actually, I didn't speak to anyone except for my immediate family until the age of about 5. It was really once I had to start elementary school. But one of the things I would do was sing. And actually, to this day, the most honest and deep portrayal of my emotions and understanding of how I am feeling comes from singing. My husband gets really frustrated sometimes because I'll be so frustrated. I'll be in the car and then I'll just burst into a song. And that's my way of expressing myself. So singing and acting, those are things that I think just, they were in me already, and I'm so glad that they were able to be utilized, especially with my therapy, because sometimes therapies are not very much fun, especially my physical therapy was very painful at times. And so having something that was kind of more of like a play hangout was really nice.
So before we move on to the pageant career again, you said something interesting that I kind of want to talk about. You said that when you feel emotional, you sing.
Yes, I do.
Do you sing songs? Do you just sing riffs? Are you just like what some people, you know, how Ella Fitzgerald used to do the scatting? Is that what you would do? Or, and if you were upset, are there certain songs that you sing? If you're sad, are there certain songs you sing? And do you also do that when you're happy?
Yeah. So I frequently have my Spotify playlist at the ready for whatever emotion kind of pops up to sing along to. So I do that a lot of the time. But actually, I make up songs constantly. It's actually part of my acting side. I worked with the founder of the Groundlings, Gary Austin, and one of his wonderful and dear friends, Matt Cartsonis, is a guitar player, a songwriter. He's fantastic. And so almost all of our improvisational classes and our shows we did to music, and Gary really encouraged us to improvise musically and sing different songs. So I think that was also very much his influence on me. But I love making up songs, although I have to say I probably make up the most songs when I have to go to the bathroom really badly and I'm trying to distract myself.
So if you were upset, let's say, and I remember meeting Mr. Greger, and he is a class act. He was very nice to me when I did meet him. So if he were to do something to upset you, like let's say, so I know just from being a man, women do not like it when a guy accidentally leaves the toilet seat up. That's like a big no-no.
It's a
so
huge no-no.
Would you ever make up a song about that? Is that what you mean? Like if you're frustrated, you make up your own songs. Would that be your way of letting you know? So if he heard you singing, he's like, uh-oh, what did I do now?
Ever so slightly. I think for that scenario, it would probably be more of a comedic riff of a song.
Okay.
Just a simple one. But yeah.
Okay.
No, it can be very entertaining. I think he knows if he hears the singing, maybe, you know, maybe check on her, or maybe don't go in there, just let her get her feelings out, and then when she's ready, she'll come to me.
Very good. So now let's get to your pageantry, because I do have a question I want to ask you about that. I saw something on your IMDb and I want to ask you about it.
Okay. Well, I actually, so skip ahead many a year. I graduated high school and I was going to get my bachelor's degree in journalism. I think it was the last year, my senior year, I was graduating from Cal State, and I felt like maybe I needed more individuals, like friends who had similar goals that I did. And then also having a platform and having a megaphone essentially for my philanthropic endeavors. I have been, you know, volunteering with many incredible organizations, with Read Across America. There's a lovely arts program called SoCal Hearts that goes to Compton and Watts that I've done for many years. Covenant House, which is for homeless youth in the Los Angeles area. And I felt like I wanted to kind of incorporate that social outreach aspect of my life, along with talent, being able to sing on a stage, and then also get scholarship money. All of the dollars from the Miss America organization that a contestant wins goes towards their college education. I decided, okay, well, let's try this. My mom had, I think she'd done a few pageants in her teen years, but I think that was about it. And she had mentioned a couple times in my upbringing, I'm the only girl. I have three older brothers. And so I think my mom definitely was like, oh, pageants, it's my girl. Maybe it can happen. And I had said no for all these years. And finally, I think I was 20 when I did my first pageant. And that's pretty late. A lot of people start pageants much earlier and do their teen years into their young adult. And I went out for one of the most competitive pageants in the California state. It was our local for the Los Angeles County. And my mom, she was so sweet. She had helped me figure out which one to sign up for that I'd be eligible to compete. And we had no idea. And then I showed up to, you know, 30 girls all dressed to the nines, knew how to do their hair and makeup perfectly. And I felt like the odd man out. I am so surprised I came back the next year. I was very intimidated, but I really loved the pageant directors. And I figured, you know, let's do this again. Let's try again. And so I did a few more pageants, and I actually won Miss Pasadena 2014, and I had incredible directors, and I got to go to state, and it was extremely exciting, and I got the pageant bug. So I went back and I did another pageant, and I became Miss Hollywood, and that was incredible and so much fun to rock the Miss Hollywood sash and crown. Yeah. I pretty much took photo ops anywhere and everywhere for my entire year.
I was about to ask, what are the perks of a Miss Hollywood?
So that it was very fun. I got to help out. One of my favorite things I got to do was go down to the IHOP in Hollywood, and you serve pancakes on Pancake Day. It's National Pancake Day, and all of the dollars donated were going to Children's Miracle Network hospitals. So the Children's Hospital in Los Angeles was the one that was receiving those donations. And that's actually Seattle Children's Hospital saved my life when I was born. They worked tirelessly to make sure that I survived. So it was really nice to get to give back to that same organization. And I also really enjoyed, they have the police station in Hollywood has foster children as their pen pals, and it's as in the bowling pins. So we went and did this big fundraiser at the bowling alley, and they do several different events, and they partner up kind of like a Big Brother program with the different foster youth in the Hollywood area. So that
did
was
you do
really
it at
exciting.
Lucky Strike?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, okay. I thought I kind of figured that.
Yeah, no, so that. Much fun. And then my final year, I had actually just graduated with my master's in mass communications, and I moved back to my hometown of Seattle. And so when I was up there, I debated about continuing to do pageants and figured it was my last year of eligibility So I competed for my hometown title of Miss Seattle and I won. I was so excited. Our Seahawks won that same weekend. So we were, it was just so much fun, so exciting. And then I actually got to raise more funds for the Seattle Children's Hospital, as I said, that saved my life at birth. So it was really just kind of a dream come true. And many wonderful things actually came out of that. I would visit the Seattle Children's Hospital several times throughout that year. And I started a program called the Sunshine Sessions. And I had what did I all do? We sang. I had friends come and play guitar. We donated different children's books. And we went around to the entire hospital, various units, and sang and hung out and read books together. And we did that several times throughout that year. And it was such a wonderful time. And I actually got to bring some of my local friends who were celebrities. So I brought my friend RJ Mitty, and he's from Breaking Bad, and my friend Jordan Fry, who was in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And so lots of fun things to hopefully brighten their day.
Awesome. You are listening to On the Level with J. Lewis Mills. You can call in if you have any questions for Ms. Greger at 1-888-627-6008. That is 1-888-627-6008. So I wanted to ask you, I was, doing my little 5 minutes of research before my show because I don't do any research because I like to be organic in my questions and your answers and all of that. I don't do the 2 or 3 day research and looking up people. So I just looked real quickly at your IMDb, but I saw in 2019 you sang the national anthem at a Seattle Mariners game.
Yes, I did. And I actually sang at an Anaheim Angels game as well.
How did both of those opportunities come about? How nervous were you? And the night before, did you have a dream that you forgot the lyrics to the song?
Oh, so sad, so true. I have reached out a few different times to both Angels and Mariners. Mariners, hometown, Seattle, got to be my number one.
Yes.
But Angels, close second, and definitely the team I rooted for all those years while I was in California.
Okay.
So it's kind of a toss-up. I did joke with our lovely Angels representative who was there with me. And said that, thank goodness you guys aren't playing the Mariners because I might be rooting for the Mariners otherwise. I definitely have had major fears of forgetting the lyrics to our national anthem. I think most singers do. I think that's a
Yes.
common concern. I hope I'm not the only one.
No,
I
you're not.
actually, though, as Miss Seattle, I did tons of national anthem singing for the University of Washington. That's my dad's alma mater. I was a Husky through and through. I actually didn't realize that at football games, you don't like do a dog bark as your rally noise because we're the Huskies, we're the dogs. So I would, ho, ho, ho. So that's what I thought you always did. And I came to California for college and that wasn't the case. And people looked at me a little weird. So I'm a big Husky fan, and we love college sports. So I performed, countless times, volleyball, basketball, softball, baseball, all of their different games throughout that year, which was incredible practice. I'm so glad I did it. So a definitely a smaller crowd compared to the 33,000, 39,000 that were at those games. And so very good stomping grounds, practice it out. Let's get the kinks worked out. So I wasn't so worried, but I always do have a slight panic right before. I
Was
can't help it.
the first one that you did was the Seattle Mariners, and then you did the Angels?
Other way around, I actually sang
Angel
for the
first.
Angels the week of my wedding. It was about 4 5 days after I got married, and I told my husband, I was like, even if we were planning on going on honeymoon immediately, I would say no because I'm singing for the Angels. So we actually postponed our honeymoon. And I said, no, this is more important to me. Sorry, love you.
Do you get anything more than just being able to go and watch the game when you do something like that for a Major League Baseball team?
Typically, it's you get like a certain number of tickets. They gave me like concession money as well. It was really cute. They
Wow.
wanted to like make the most of it. The Mariners gave us box seats, so it was like the top, thing. We're like staring at the
Yeah.
players hanging out, and it's like very cool. And family members getting to come and enjoy, and I was super excited about the Mariners because it was also their dog night, bring your dog to the park night. And I'm a
Okay.
huge fan of animals, dogs in particular. So my family all joked that clearly they chose this day especially for me. They knew.
Do you have any aspirations of doing more anthems, or do you think that doing them in those big crowds, because, and I mean, I heard you say earlier that you had done so many anthems for the University of Washington sports program, but being in front of 30,000 plus, I don't care if I would have written the national anthem myself, I am almost guaranteeing I would have forgot something. So I'm just thinking that just being in that big of a crowd. Now, yes, you're a performer, yes, you're an actor, and we love to perform, but it's not every day that we are in front of 30,000 plus people. So
Right. It's a
is that
unique
something
experience.
very unique? Is that something that you would do over and over again, or is this just a maybe once a year, twice a year type thing for you?
Honestly, I feel like I enjoyed it so much. I would probably just do it over and over and over again. It's why I did it for the UW as many times as I did too. I just really enjoy it, and I love sports. I am such a fan of watching a sporting event, and baseball especially. I love football and I love baseball. Basketball's harder for me because I'm from Seattle and they stole our Supersonics many years ago, and I haven't really quite forgiven them for that. So until I get my Supersonics back, it might be a while till I'm up for a basketball game.
Okay.
But no, I really love it, and I think it's every time pretty much that I've sung the national anthem, I love singing it. It's such a wonderful patriotic song to get to sing, and it's such an honor. After singing, my favorite compliment that I ever receive is that people enjoy that I do just a straight original kind of the natural and normal version. No crazy riffs, no
Yes.
big to-dos, because day. It's not about me as the singer. It's about the song. It's about all those who are fighting for our country, those who've died for our country. That's what matters. And so I've had many veterans come up to me and thank me for doing just a straight rendition of it. And being able to have them appreciate that so much is what warms my heart. So I get very emotional when I sing it. I love it. It's just, it's almost like the entire world fades away, even though I'm on, this field, this diamond, and
Yes,
there's
yes.
thousands of people behind me. I just kind of tune them all out, and I'm looking at the flag, and it's just the flag in me.
Okay. And here is my last question about this, and again, it's going to be a bit controversial,
Oh, goodness.
especially because of, the time that we live in today. But because you have such a respect for the anthem, because you have such a respect for the flag, how would you feel? I can't believe I'm about to ask you this, but I'm going to.
Of course you are. It's you.
How would you feel if somebody were at a sporting event and they took a knee while they were singing the national anthem?
I think that that's a difficult question to answer in many different ways, but I do recognize it is our right to to do as we see fit. And depending on what they feel their reason is behind that, there are many different reasons that could be very valid to taking a knee. I personally would never take a knee. I am very proud and want to stand there, you know, hand over heart. That baseball cap is off. I'm singing it all. And I don't think I've ever had anyone do that when I was at an event. In general, I hope that my singing and my hope and love for the country and for our citizens would maybe bring them to recognizing that that's the focus of what I'm doing and why I'm there singing it. So
very
maybe
good
it
answer.
Won't change. Yeah, maybe it won't change what they do about how they feel, but hopefully they recognize that that's where I'm coming from.
I like that answer a lot.
Thank you.
I like that answer.
Oh, one fun fact too. Probably, I have to say this. My favorite place I've ever sung the national anthem was for my absolute dear friend who just became a brigadier general. And it was at her ceremony in earlier this year in the Hall of Heroes at the Pentagon. I got to sing the national anthem for her change of command to become a brigadier general.
Wow. Did she ask you to do it, or she asked you to do it?
She asked me to do it. And there was like dozens of generals in the audience. And I mean, I'd say 90% of the people there were military. And that was terrifying.
Did you cry when she asked you?
Oh, of course. I was so emotional. And she talked about it after I sang. I was so glad she didn't talk about it or talk to me before I sang. I couldn't have done it. I would have just been a little balled up throat. Couldn't do it.
That had to have been. And I mean, I was going to say, you know, I know I said that's going to be my last question, but my last question was going to be, where was your favorite spot? So just real quick, and then I want to move on to the acting and production side of what you've been doing. But what was it like? What was your feeling when you were at the Pentagon? Was it a larger than life experience when you were up there singing? Was it like an out of body type situation? What was it like to be there for you, since you have already spoken to how highly you regard, you know, the military, the anthem, and the flag? What was that like for you?
It was very surreal, I have to say. We had actually just done a tour through the Pentagon, a private tour. And so there were so many emotions, and they have their 9/11 memorial for those who passed away from the Pentagon. And it was just one of those feelings of everything that you can imagine about just all that people have been through, our country's been through. And even knowing my absolute dear, dear friend, all she's been through, being one of the first women to be a brigadier general, one of the first in the Air Force, it's just a lot of incredible accomplishments. And I'm not saying there was a weight on my shoulders, but there was definitely a lot on my mind when I was there and singing it. And I pretty much every time just try to breathe. I always pray right before I sing, pray that I remember the words, that I hit those notes, that I don't overcome with too much emotion. But then I sit there and say, you know, I'm just going to enjoy this, because this only happens once. So just take it all in. And that's honestly it. As I sing through, there's many kind of breaks in the song that I do just kind of breathe and enjoy that moment. And standing up there, it was very surreal, but it was beautiful, and it clearly meant so much to her that I felt very successful and especially honored.
And how many people would you say were, I know you said that there were a lot of generals, former general or generals in the audience. How many people would you say were there listening to that rendition?
I'd say it's a pretty intimate space, the Hall of Heroes. I'm not 100% sure how many she had. We packed the house, though, but it was still, I mean, I'd say Definitely over 100. I have no
Okay.
idea how much, though. I'd like to say that I'm better at gauging this, but I am not.
So the reason I asked that question is, just for every reason that you just gave of it being a surreal moment, and as I said, your love of the military flag anthem, all of that, would you say you were more nervous doing that than you were standing on a baseball diamond?
Yes. So much more intimate, and all these people know it by heart. They
Yeah,
live
that's
and
right.
breathe it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay, so let's move on to one thing I wanted to talk to you about. As I said in my introduction of you, we met on the set of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And as I said,
Yeah, we
I
did.
tell people that that was a master class that I got paid for. And the cool thing for me was, well, the cool thing for me was Mr. Tarantino asked me to be in his movie. That was the cool thing. But the cool on one of the cool on set things was, like, even though we as land pirates, even though we didn't have any lines, each one of us had a respectable resume, right? So I'm sitting at the table, and I did not know this for probably the first hour that we were doing the scene. I'm sitting next to Radame from Juice, the movie with Tupac, and I mean, we're sitting there, we're talking, and he looked straight. And because I was sitting on his left side, when he was looking straight ahead, I got a profile. And I looked at him and I was like, wait a minute. I don't mean to talk out of school, man, but am I sitting next to Radame from Juice? And he started laughing and he was like, yeah. So for me, just to be asked to do something like that, it didn't matter. And I mean, I tell people this all day. It doesn't matter if I spoke in the movie, I'm in a Quentin Tarantino movie. That's all I needed to hear. That's all I needed. Even when I went to the audition, Mr. Tarantino said, if you don't get the role that you're auditioning for, would you still be in my movie? Because I want you in my film. I looked at him, was like, buddy, that's all you had to say. I'm good. Just let me know when. And that was basically the audition. So because I saw it the way I did, and I was an actor, because you were working in production, I don't know if you can tell us how you got to be a part of production, but what was your out of body, so to speak, experience on that set? Like, once it was all said and done and you had a chance to sit down and take a breath, how big was that really for you to work in production on such a big film?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. It was the best master class. I definitely, it was exciting. I started first during pre-production. I was working in the production coordination office. I was, just kind of doing some assistant work, front desk work, a great way for me to meet lots of different people. Trying to memorize names was insane. I really enjoyed it. So many cool people kind of came through that revolving door. I learned a lot to do with the different departments. I had never worked. I personally have like produced some small short films and like lower budget type projects, nothing of that magnitude, nothing of that quality. So just in general, there are so many different departments, and understanding all of their inner workings was really just, I mean, mind-blowing, trying to keep it all straight. So getting to be there from pre-production and get to know everybody was so helpful. And then when I transitioned to set, I was the cast assistant. So I got to be there with you. That's one of the reasons why we got to hang out as much as we did, because I was there assisting cast. So I It was so funny because I remember starting and thinking to myself, oh dear God, what exactly does a cast assistant do?
Oh.
What are they expecting of me? And honestly, it was so absurd, ridiculous, fun, enjoyable, amazing. It was truly a masterclass. I learned so much from so many people. I had heart-to-heart conversations with incredible Oscar winners,
Yes,
with
ma'am.
individuals who had been working and able to sustain a career in the entertainment industry their whole life, which is not an easy feat.
No.
It is a difficult world to live in. And I was really excited because, one, being an actor and a performer, watching so many incredible, talented actors, actresses, even the stunt crew, our stunt team was incredible. Some of the stuff that
Oh,
they
yeah.
did, I was taking care of our Nazis that we set on fire, and those guys, they are crazy. I love them all. They're so much fun. I had such a great time. But them getting set on fire multiple times for these takes, I'm like, the mentality to do this, the bravery to do this, it's insane. My family was joking. They're like, so who'd you take care of this time? It's like, oh, I had, my nine Nazis. I had to make sure that they were okay. Well, okay, until we set them on fire. Then if they weren't okay, then it was someone else's problem. I got to hang out with Al Pacino. I had the hugest crush on Timothy Oliphant, and I
Oh,
did
yeah.
struggle to drive the golf cart when he was on it,
Yeah.
and he definitely made fun of me, but that's okay. We
Yeah,
had
he thought it
fun.
was really cool that, the first time I saw him on set, I didn't know he was going to be there. So when I first
Right.
saw him, I was like, dude, I totally watched Santa Clarita Diet.
Yes,
And
such a good show.
we became, like, I'm not going to say we became the best of friends, but he always said hello to me after that. And we always had conversation. Even our, and just so I'm not name dropping, but a funny story with our main stunt coordinator. You know who I'm talking about? Okay. So I am walking and I'm looking for water. The water, I thought that there was a cooler for water on set. And looking at her from behind, she had on her crew belt with her walkie and everything else. I thought she was just a crew member. So I walk up to her full wardrobe because I'm on set, and sure she has her back towards me, and I say, excuse me, do you know where I can find some water? And she turned around and I was like, oh my God, you're. And then I said her name and she was like, oh, you're so sweet. And when I went to, she was like, I think the water is outside. And I was like, I'm so sorry. I did not mean to ask you where the water was. I thought that you were one of the production assistants. And she was like, oh, don't worry. No worries. No worries. And I
And
was like,
she
well,
looks so young. She looks
yes.
good.
Yes. And I was like, do you need any water? And
Right.
she
You're
was
like,
like,
can I help you now?
exactly. I'll be once I realized, because when I first, and this is the crazy part about this whole story, when I first saw her in Death Proof, that was the very
Right.
first time I
Oh my
saw her.
God, she's incredible in that.
And I was like, if I ever get a chance to meet this woman, I'm gonna tell her how cool I thought her role was. And then I was like, wait, there's no way in the world I'm ever
That
gonna
you're gonna
meet her.
do it.
And when
I
I
love
met
it.
her, I was so struck that I didn't end up telling her that until, I don't remember, one of the events afterwards. So when you say that you are able to look, I was able to stand and have a conversation and really get into Miss Robbie's mind about Harley Quinn. And
Yeah.
I told her, I was like, look, I don't know how you're going to take this, but there were a few auditions where I actually watched Suicide Squad just so I could see you. I studied you for some roles that I did. So, just being able, that's why I say it was a master class. Just the people that were involved that I was able to speak to, or when I'm going in for a wardrobe fitting the people that I'm seeing. I'm like, dude, pinch yourself right now because you just walked by a 3-time Oscar winner and he's saying hello to you first, you know? And, you know, it was kind of cool. A lot of people happened to, you know, they dug the eye patch and, you know, that's,
yeah, they did.
That's all well and good. Once it was over, were you sad? I was.
Oh, I was sad. Well, and I had been working since May, I think is when I started working. And the last day, I actually wrapped out the very final day of the production office. And it was like almost the end of December. It was like Christmas. I had spent so many months with these people. Like, they were family. I got engaged during the time that the production was happening. Like, the people who were congratulating me were, you know, Shannon McIntosh and David Heyman. And, you know, it's just, that's so crazy to think. But those are the individuals who saw me, like, the next day and were so excited that, you know, that's what I got to share that with these people. And they were so warm and inviting and truly a family. Now they had to be a family because that last week that we were filming, I think it was like 80 hours or something that we clocked. It was like, get it done. We have to finish. Yeah. And we did, but it was exhausting. Some of those days, some of those nights, it got long, but everyone loves what they're doing. That's my favorite thing about Quentin, is that he has such a passion for it. There's no way to be around him and not be enthusiastic about what you're working on, because he has so much energy and enjoyment while he's working that it is infectious. Everyone realizes this is why we're here. This is an incredible, exciting movie, and we get to be a part of it. And even if that's a small part of it, it's still important. And we all feel important, because without each and every one of us, it wouldn't happen. And that's where that family mentality definitely comes in. I'm still friends with many people. I just had the greatest time. So it was definitely a masterclass. It was family camaraderie. Several people who I worked with there were at my wedding. You know, it's just, it's one of those things, you'll remember it forever. And I have notebooks. I have tons of little notebooks where I wrote things. And that was one of my favorite things, is like every day there was something incredible happening, whether it was, you know, learning from Tim Monick, who's an incredible dialect coach. He himself went, I do believe it was Carnegie Mellon that he went to, and he was, I mean, he's just incredible. And learning from him, because he was helping Margot with getting into that accent for Sharon Tate. And I think a couple other people, and having him there and listening to how he worked, and he spent time and talked to me when I had questions. Everyone did. Everyone was so enjoying what they were doing. If you had a question, they were more than willing to answer and help you understand further.
Yeah. Even if you had a question for Quentin, because there were a couple of times where I had questions, and, you know, after the first one, I guess he could tell how apprehensive I was. He's like, don't worry about asking me a question, buddy. Just whatever you got, just give it to me. And the one thing that was one of the things that I really loved about working for that man is, no matter who you were, and I mean this to a degree, but no matter who you were, he had the utmost respect for you. Like, us as actors, he didn't say, you know, you really shouldn't have a question for me. You're not one of the main actors. You're not Leonardo. You're not Timothy. Right. You're not, you know, he wasn't going doing that. He treated everybody equally. And I will always say, you know, when he called me One Eye continuously, that was a term of endearment. He didn't mean that. Somebody actually came up to me and they said, doesn't it piss you off that he keeps calling you One Eye? And I'm like, wait, what? And they're like, doesn't that upset you because he keeps calling you One Eye? And I'm like, listen, bruh, I am on a Quentin Tarantino set at Universal Studios. What in the world do I have to be upset with? because
Right.
if he says I forget the scene, but he was telling you just said his name, the producer.
David Heyman.
David. Yeah. He told David, he was like, go get me one eye. David knew who he was talking about. Everybody knew
Right.
who he was talking about. So just the fact that he can get that comfortable with his actors in a
Yeah.
short amount of time makes you as an actor even more comfortable. And I have to believe that he was the same way with production, because he, in a sense, is closer to production than he is to his actors. So the whole way around, it was just, I mean, dude, even the nurse was cool. You know,
Yep. Our medic is the best. I
everybody
love her.
was cool. Do you think, what will you take in a professional sense? What was your big takeaway from that opportunity?
That's so hard, especially thinking of like a singular one. At the end of the day, I definitely felt like if you put your heart and your soul into what you're working on, it really does come back tenfold. And if you find others who believe in you and what you're working on as well, it'll just be bountiful. Your success, your happiness, your enjoyment, especially with the entertainment industry, we have to give so much. We literally blood, sweat, and tears. It all goes into it. It is a labor of love. It's a lot of work. It's long hours. It's exhausting. You get hurt, you get tired. Sometimes it doesn't feel like it's going to be worth it. But if you've come into it knowing it's everything that you wanted it to be, everything that you've wanted to put forward in your project, and you have people who believe you, I just really see that it comes full circle. Everything really does blossom in such a wonderful way. And that's one thing, as like you were saying, Quentin Tarantino works with incredible people, and many of them he's worked with for many, many years. His scripty has been with him since Reservoir Dogs, and many of them since, Pulp Fiction and Kill Bill, and just, I mean, the amount of years that they've spent together, it is that family. And one of the reasons is they see all that he has to offer, and they have lots to offer to that project as well. And it is a labor of love, and heart is at the center of it.
Now, dealing with just to kind of tie all of this in together as to why I had you on the show,
In case people don't know, they're like, oh, what is this girl here?
with your cerebral palsy and autism, were there ever any days that it was, a job for you? It was hard for you? And if so, can you just kind of explain to the listeners how that whole thing played out for you?
Well, I think especially because with the autism, a lot of people have no idea that I'm autistic now. I've got to preface this now. People who didn't know me until in the last, I'd say, 5 years, usually have no idea, and they typically don't know about the cerebral palsy either. Before I did pageants, I was a very different person. The pageants really helped kind of open me up. It made me have to do public speaking, interviewing, all sorts of stuff. So that was so important. And really, I don't think I could have done this job without all of that in my back pocket, because it would have been overwhelming. There were days it was. There were definitely days it was overwhelming, and it was hard. I have to say, for the cerebral palsy, that usually had to do with a lot of the physical barriers, whether it was 115 degree heat in the Santa Clarita area, or it was walking up and down in Simi Valley, that hill of the George Spahn Ranch, that killed me a couple times. And things like that definitely physically got in the way, but luckily I had other wonderful people who, if there was something I needed assistance with, I just had to say. And like you said, our set medic, Erica, was incredible. So if something was going wrong or I just, my body just wasn't doing it that day, sometimes it would be, okay, well, let me massage this out and fix that, that kink in that muscle, or let me give you some ice packs or an extra brace, something to help take away that. So she was so on the ball. And then many other people who are always happy and ready to step up to the plate if there was something that needed to get done. The autism was a little more difficult. It's so funny. I was so excited when I got engaged and also terrified because the idea of going back to work and having anyone know and having that attention from, I mean, there's 150 people on set any given day. And that was daunting and stressful. I didn't tell anyone for hours. And the first person I told, the first couple people, were my immediate coworkers and my immediate supervisor. And it was just because I didn't want them to feel bad, like I didn't want to tell them. So that always is in the back of my mind, having doubts that people won't understand where I'm coming from and that they will have a negative reaction to me not reacting the right way or doing something the right way. Those thoughts and concerns are very present still, but I definitely dealt with it well. Everyone seemed very happy, but it was in a way having to tell people at the time I felt comfortable talking about it, because if everyone knew all at once, that I knew that would be too much for me. At one point during that day, I did like step away and take my break and have my moment alone to process and deal with those emotions and that attention that I don't necessarily want. I appreciate it, but not in that magnitude.
So there
were times for sure, but even especially with the Land Pirates being so early on in our shooting schedule, there were a lot of you guys. Keeping track of you was quite difficult.
Yeah, I bet
You were good. You were pretty good. You didn't go off too often. And there were a few times where people would just run away, and trying to keep track of you all was very difficult. But,
which I never understood, because I'm like, why isn't everybody else standing here watching this?
This is
a masterpiece going on. Where are y'all going?
I know. But you know, some of them are like, no, we're good. We took this class already.
Yeah.
we'll go take our smoke break.
So my last question for you is this. This is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Anybody that has seen the movie has seen the really cool Los Angeles or the really cool California landmarks that Quentin was able to put into his movie. One of the coolest things for me was just seeing the way he was able. It was a cool thing to see how he was able to transform Hollywood Boulevard, even though there were some of the store owners that, you know, it took a while to get them in, to get them signed on in order to let him change it and make it look like the 60s. But the cool part of that was there were a lot, when it was time to take that stuff down, there were several that asked if they could keep it the way it was. But just for you, as someone that was working on the movie, what was it like outside of doing the movie, what was it like to be able to say, you know, you've been here, you've been here, you've been here, wherever it was, whatever monumental place it was, what was it like to say you were there as well? Which one of the landmark places that were used was your favorite?
So I have to say, my favorite was that we highlighted Musso and Franks as much as we did. I loved it. I thought that was incredible. I had actually never gone to Musso and Frank's to eat until that movie, till we started shooting. And then I took like all my family members, because I was like, how in the world are we such film buffs? We love Hollywood. We have been here. We've been a part of this world for so long, yet none of us have come to Musso and Frank's. It's travesty. We must go. And I loved it. Getting to work with Sonny, who was their bartender, and Sergio. Sadly, Sergio passed away. And I was really sad by that. He was such a wonderful man. And he was the, I think, the longest of the waiters who was still remaining there when we filmed. And it was such a great time and such an honor to work with them and the stories they had, the people they knew, those that they've waited on, that they've made drinks for. Just endless amounts of Hollywood history that they had, and getting to absorb that as much as possible and take down as many little notes as I could just was wonderful. It was such a joy. And luckily we didn't have to bring it back to what it looked like back then, because it has remained very similar to its original. And I think their newest update, their additional room that they added, was in like the 50s, I think, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, it goes back a long ways. Charlie Chaplin would go hang out there. Yeah. So it was just such a great place to get to be a part of. And we were there for so long because of having some substantial scene work there. So we were there for like over a week, and that was incredible. And the food's amazing there. The drinks are great. People should check it out.
Absolutely. And I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention Mr. Luke Perry. You know, he passed, and the first movie I did with him, the first time I was able to work with him was, and if you have the Roku channel, you are my listeners, if any of you have the Roku channel, there's this movie, there was an NBC movie of the week, and it was called Invasion, and it was him, Rebecca Gayhart, John Polito, Jason Shambia, Chris Orr, I can't remember who else, but that was the first time I worked with him, and that was in 1997. I was still living in Arizona at this time. I mean, nowhere near an acting career. I would just, if there were any films that were in Phoenix, I knew that it was easy money to just go and stand around, and we would get food. Be able to eat. Now, fast forward to the pre-production party. I'm standing at the bar, and I turn around, and coming up to me, I mean, Mr. Perry walked up to me, and he was like, "Hi, I'm Luke Perry. It's nice to meet you." And I was like, "Dude, fucking Luke, man." And he looked at me weird, and I was like, "I know you don't remember me, but I was a background guy in the movie Invasion that you did out in Phoenix." And he was like, "Oh my gosh, that was so long ago." And I was like, "Yeah, is Mitch still your bodyguard?" And he was like, "Wow, you have a good memory." And I was like, "You know, there's something else I remember too. You were supposed to call Lorne Michaels back because you were supposed to be on Saturday Night Live, and you totally forgot. And you got up and you ran out of the room and went back to your trailer and called him." And he's like, "Now you're scaring me."
That's wonderful. What a funny thing to remember.
It was such a cool thing. And you know, they, for part of that Invasion, they had me dressed up like a chef, and they had me in one of those real silly chef hats, and I was like, "Dude, I don't want to wear this." You know, I was standing outside of the wardrobe, and his trailer was right next to the wardrobe trailer, and he was coming out of his trailer, and he pointed at me, and he was about to say something, and I was like, "Yeah, I know, I look like Chef Boy, are you black, don't I?" And he just busted out laughing. So, you know, just to be able to work with him on something else. And the last words that man said to me was, you know, I was saying goodbye to him the last day that we were filming. And he's like, because, you know, the Land Pirates were done a few days before he was done. And he said, "You know, I've only got a couple more days and then I'm done." He's like, "Well, I guess I'll see you at the rap party." And I never got a chance to see him at the rap party. So it was pretty sad for me. I mean, I loved the movie 100%, but it kind of hit my heart a bit when we were at the screening and, you know, his part came on. I don't know how much you had to, how closely you dealt with him, but, you know, he was a stand-up guy. And I know that for his close friends and his family, I can completely understand why he is uberly missed as he is.
Yeah, no, he is just one of the most amazing people. I was so lucky to get to know him, even for such a brief amount of time. It still gets me choked up. He was such an incredible person.
Yes.
I remember it was his last, I think it was his last day on set, and he was in his Bengal outfit.
Yeah.
And I had a very similar hat and kind of a similar outfit on because it was very hot, and that's essentially the best thing you can wear if you are running around in the California heat on a production set. So I had all my garb on and I had my hat, and it was so funny because he had mentioned me. He's like, oh yeah, let's make sure we don't forget to take a picture, especially because we are like twins today.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, oh yeah, totally. Well, I mentioned to him at the end of the day, I was like, hey, yeah, I know you said that you want, like, you know, you'd do that picture and I'd really like that. I'd appreciate it. He felt it was so important to get the perfect scenery for our outfits. And because you can't have phones on set, we had to like trudge around the whole set to get to our phones, even to then exit the area that you're to where you're allowed to use the phone. And it took us like 30 minutes. It was forever. And he was wrapped and totally could have gone home and that would be that. But no, he was like, no. And the best part was that he knew it was important to me. He knew I really was excited about getting that picture and that we were, you know, twinsies and stuff. Mm-hmm. But it was that he made it important to him.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about it being important to me. It was something that he took on as something important to him. And I think that's the best way to show it. It's he literally, if he saw anything was necessary or important to another individual, he took it on as his own to make sure that those things happen too. And I absolutely love that man. Such a sweetheart. He was so he was honestly like the cowboy through and through too. Loved it. He was so chill on set. He just kind of lived in that world. We were, you know, Universal backlot, hanging out in the Western town, and he just fit. Everything about him just fit there. And I absolutely loved his acting. I really wish people could see his blue outfit in all of its glory that he wore. And hopefully they'll release that sometime, because that was the best. I love that outfit. Yeah. And so did he. He thought it was hilarious. He thought it was so much fun and just effortless. His acting and his capabilities to do just about anything. It was just, he was like, oh yeah, I can do that. Oh yeah, I'll ride the horse and do the thing. I can do that. And he could. He was such a good soul. And it was so funny because I took care of him on set, similar to like I did with you guys, the Land Pirates. Mm-hmm. And it was so cute. He had his son later came and did one of our like extra background kind of featured extra spots. And he's like, take care of my son. He's coming. I met him there, met his daughter. They were so sweet, and told him, yeah, I'll take care of him. And he's like, yeah, you'll take care of him. Like, you've taken care of me, made sure, you know, that make sure they don't get up to any, you know, mischievousness, be good. And actually I did get to see him at the wrap party, and I introduced him to my fiance at the time. Mm-hmm. And he was so sweet. He was so excited that we had gotten engaged, and actually said that he and his lovely fiance were going to babysit our kids one day. Like, that, it was the sweetest thing. It was the saddest day, though, when I saw that he had passed, like, mm-hmm. broke down crying. Mm-hmm. And it is because he's such an incredible soul. You feel the absence of that. And you need more people in the world who are like that.
Yes. Now, my last conversation, or my last story, because you brought it up, would be about Checkpoint Charlie.
Yes.
With our telephones. You want to talk about Nazis.
Oh,
y'all were the I don't remember mm-hmm. that cat's name that was that stayed behind there.
Yep.
But
Spencer.
That dude, Spencer, yes. That dude was a Nazi to the point that he absolutely did. I decided that I was going to start messing with people. And I don't know if you were ever around when I did this, but like, I forgot what Quentin's assistant's name was, but it doesn't matter. You know who I'm talking about. We were actually on set, and she had her back to me, and I was talking to somebody. I think it was one of the other land pirates. I was like, "So, these pictures that I have from on set, do you think I can put them on my Instagram now, or do you think I should wait?" And I was totally just saying that for her to hear me. Man, that chick whipped around so fast, it was funny. And then we were standing out off of set, and David was standing out there talking to somebody, and I did the same thing to him. And he whipped around quick. He's like, "Wait, what did you say? What did you just say? What picture are you talking about?" And I was like, "Dude, you can ask him, bro. I don't even have my phone. I'm just messing with you." So yeah, Checkpoint Charlie was
We kept
pretty.
things under wraps.
Yes.
They were not disturbed. You know, and it's so hard, especially nowadays, everybody has their phone. Everyone's, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and that's all fine and dandy. But when you're trying to make a killer movie and you want these exciting surprises and fun little things, honestly, I always listen to my mom talk about going, especially to like the drive-in movie theater, and you wouldn't know, or maybe have ever even seen a trailer or know anything about the film. And you just kind of get the title of the film, maybe the people who are in the film, and that was it. And then you had to choose what movie you were watching.
Yeah.
And she wound up going to some really awesome movies and had no idea how much fun she was going to have. And there is something to be said about being surprised. I get so
Yes.
frustrated when I watch a trailer and it gives away all the good points of that movie. You
Yes.
have done us a disservice as the audience member. I don't want to know every turn that's coming.
Yeah.
And we might
There's no
take
need
it
to
to
go
an
watch the movie.
extreme. Exactly. But we kept things under wraps, and so thank goodness, 'cause
Yes,
if
ma'am.
we didn't, I don't know what would have happened, but I would be sad to say if something happened and Once Upon a Time didn't come out the way
Yeah.
it was supposed to. That's the thing. You just don't want any spoilers to make you have to change how you're doing what you're doing.
Absolutely. Well, Miss Greger, we made it.
We did it.
We are at the very end, and as I told you on our telephone call, I usually like to ask my guest what thought you would like to leave with my listeners that have hung in there with us for the last hour and 13 minutes.
I would say it's very important in life to recognize that you were on this journey. You have no idea. It's not a straight path. My journey for sure has not been a straight path. Many bumps and uphill battles. And I have loved every second of it, even in like the most tragic ways. During filming, my family's house actually burned down in the campfire in Paradise, and we lost everything. But having that experience has brought me to where I am today and has opened up many different doors and possibilities for the future for lots of us. And so I think that ultimately, if you are willing to go along for the ride and don't necessarily say no, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was a very odd yes for me to say, the way everything happened, and I wouldn't do it different. And hopefully, this journey will find you to exactly where you're meant to be. But
Absolutely.
I hope that things that might not always seem perfect right now, or could be quite devastating in this moment, hopefully tomorrow it'll be a little brighter and a little brighter after that.
Well, thank you. Thank you very kindly. And so, what I would like to leave listeners with is this. I know that I have some pretty intelligent listeners, so I understand that you understand why I had Miss Greger on the show tonight. Someone that is able to overcome what most people would call adversity and keep on going. Someone that would be able to take obstacles that have sidelined other people just because they feel like, I have this affliction. I have whatever it is that they have going on and I can't do. You would be surprised, as Miss Greger said, and as I said, I didn't know that Miss Greger had cerebral palsy. I didn't know that Ms. Greger was autistic, no matter what level or degree it is. I didn't know. But you, as my listeners outside of the entertainment industry, you would be surprised if you knew just which actors had what situation going on that you just don't know about. So I had Ms. Greger on this evening because I wanted to show, no matter what your obstacle, no matter what your adversity, you can get through it. You can get over it. You can still be the best version of you. I know that some people may say, well, Jay Lewis, that's easier said than done. Listen, the number one thing that I think about every day when I wake up is today the day I'm going to lose vision in my right eye? It's already gone in the left. So I wake up every day and I say, is today the day that I lose vision in my right eye? Am I going to get hit in my right eye? Am I going to have an accident? Is what's going to happen to me? Now, that's not me just manifesting negativity. That's just me living in the world of reality. But even if something like that happens, God forbid it doesn't, but even if something like that happens, life can't stop for me. My world can't stop. My work cannot stop. I'm not saying that I want this to happen, but if I were to lose my vision, I would not be able to let that affect the gift of being an actor telling stories that God has given me. I won't be able to sit and say, well, you know, let me just sit here and feel sorry for myself. I can't do that. And I believe that there are so many people that could be excelling beyond belief, but they, like me, used to be my worst enemy. And I really believe that there are so many people that are out there in this world that could be such a better version of themselves if they would just get out of their own way. When I first started doing this thing professionally, or actually when I started doing interviews, it was after the NBC show that I was on. I had people ask me, why are you doing this? What is the end game for you? What do you want to see happen? And I would tell people, I want to inspire people to be the best version of themselves. If somebody listens or hears my story and says, if J. Lewis Mills could do it, damn it, I can do it too. If Joelle Posey Greger can do it, damn it, I can do it too. I thank you all very kindly for listening. Same time, same channel next week. Again, the number was 1-888-627-6008. We got into our conversation again. I hope that I don't get cussed out for not taking calls again. But, hey, sometimes we just get into the conversation. I would like to thank Ms. Greger once again. I would like to thank you all for listening. Have a great week. Love yourselves. Love the people around you. We are out.
Are you inspired? Can I inspire you more? Come join me every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. here at BBS Radio. Let's get inspired together. Come join me. You'll be glad you did.